From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, just hours before a blizzard named Stella delivers a March sucker punch, this is NEPR News Now, stories you really shouldn't miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Coming up, nearly 2 months into the new administration, we check in with voters in a string of central Massachusetts towns that all voted for President Trump.
There needs to be more businesses. At one time, this town was booming. Everything seems to be moving to another country.
A visit to Winchendon and a conversation with some of those million-plus Bay Staters who voted for Donald Trump. Then a young man who got to know the country one step at a time.
Walking became both my lover and my enemy, you know. It became my teacher. It became a meditation. And it was miserable, too.
And we wrap up on news that LIGO is recognizing the women of NASA. It's been a tough road. Among the opponents to women astronauts?
John Glenn was among those who testified. Men go off and fight the wars and fly the airplanes, he said. It is a fact of our social order.
The latest commentary from Martha Ackman. All that and more just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, in his revised executive order, President Trump has cut the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. by more than half. But since the fall of last year, nearly 1,800 refugees have already resettled in New England, and more than a third of them are children and teens. As part of our Facing Change project, New England Public Radio's Nancy Cullen reports on the challenges facing these students in school and how educators are addressing them.
At Colburn Elementary School in West Springfield, Massachusetts, students come from all over the world.
My mom and dad are from Sudan.
My mom and dad are from Iraq.
Turkey.
Afghanistan.
Nepal.
I'm from Iraq.
Most of the English language learners here arrive as refugees. Inside an English language learning classroom, second graders learn English along with math.
If I have halves.
If I have halves.
I have two equal parts.
I have two equal parts.
I have two parts that are the same size.
Teacher Steph Duggan uses words, drawings, and hand signals to describe math vocabulary. The children watch, listen, repeat, and then explain the concepts to each other.
It is have a same size and same shape.
Working with one student is a teacher's aide who was once a refugee student herself.
I'm Sarah Almula. I'm from Iraq, and I came with no English.
Almula's father worked as a translator for the American military in Mosul, but it became unsafe. The family fled to Kurdistan, then 6 years ago to West Springfield, where Almula started high school.
I felt like I couldn't do it, and it was so hard, and I had no friends, I had nothing, and everything was new to me.
Almula, who's now in college, says a turning point came when a history teacher wanted to know her story.
He was, like, asking about our culture and asking about home and so many things that he really care about, and it made me feel like I want to learn more.
Inviting refugee students to share their history is a way to help them feel a part of a school.
Make them feel happy and wanted.
Ken Pransky first taught students who were refugees 30 years ago in Amherst.
It was pretty traumatic. Their families had just been a part of the Cambodian Holocaust, and they were living in refugee camps. And they were coming with T-shirts and shorts and sandals in the winter. Many of them actually had never been to school.
Pransky recalls some kids were so overwhelmed by the large brick school with hundreds of students, at first they hid under the tables.
Expectations are different, weather's different, food is different, everything is different, and it's scary.
Joan Snowden also learned a lot from teaching Cambodian refugees. Today she teaches English language learners at Amherst High School. She says if a student has experienced trauma, when teachers are consistent and predictable, that helps them learn.
It really helps kids to feel like they're in control of their lives if they've had times where they were not in control of their lives and when no one was in control of the situation.
Snowden even writes the date and the class agenda on the same place on the board every day and makes sure they're prepared for the bells.
It really helps them to know that the bells ring at 7:45, that this is what happens in this building. This is where this club always meets. So they can start to feel this is their community. This is their school. They belong here and they're safe here.
Some kids last attended school in refugee camps or haven't been in months, years, or ever. Julie Sugarman is an analyst with the Migration Policy Institute.
Students who have never been to school would need to understand what school is and how one behaves and everything that we take for granted about understanding what schools are. They might not have literacy skills in any language, and so they need to learn how to read and how to write while they're learning English.
Doing this well can cost schools more money for more staff.
The refugee funding specifically is a tiny amount. The only funding that I know of that is specifically dedicated to refugees is the Refugee School Impact Grant, and that's about $14.6 million for the whole country.
The New England states received about $1.4 million, with the lion's share going to Massachusetts, which has the most refugees in the region.
That money is meant for additional English as a second language, for after-school programs, maybe for interpretation or working with parents. But it's really very, very limited and goes only to a few school districts within a state. So most refugees are served through the same kind of funding as other English learners.
And in fact, schools are supposed to treat refugees the same way as any other student, not according to their immigration status, but according to their educational needs. Colleen Marcus, the director of English language learning in West Springfield, says her district gets creative when it comes to funding, for example, when they're hiring teachers' aides.
Looking for somebody who speaks a second language, a language that's going to help our students and our teachers and our families, is just smart.
West Springfield even has a custodian who speaks Nepali. He taught math in a refugee school in Nepal. When asked about the challenges of educating children who are refugees, Colleen Marcus insists there are only benefits.
What we learn from these children and these families about life and love and family and perseverance is a gift to all of us.
As one teacher put it, having students who are refugees makes us bring our game to the next level, and all students benefit. For New England Public Radio, I'm Nancy Cohen.
Although we think of Massachusetts as a solidly blue state, more than a million Bay State residents voted for Donald Trump last November. So now we're going to begin an occasional series we're calling 1 Million, Red Voters in a Blue State. In central Massachusetts, you can actually drive from the New Hampshire border south to the Connecticut line and pass through a solid line of towns which all voted for Trump. WBUR's Anthony Brooks now takes us to Winchendon, a Worcester County town with a population of 10,000.
There are signs of life along Central Street in Winchendon, but also signs of economic decline, empty storefronts in the place still known as Toy Town, even though the toy industry left long ago. Winchendon is like many struggling towns in the American Rust Belt, hoping for better times ahead. And that's why a lot of people here voted for Donald Trump.
This place was booming with business years ago. You drive around town and you'll see all the empty boarded up factories.
This is Jesse Algarin. He's the co-owner and the chef of the Hometown Cafe on Central Street in Winchendon, which he opened 3 years ago.
No cheese on the burger?
Nope.
Thank you.
No tomato either.
Yep.
Along with his burgers, Algarin is proud of his homemade cakes, pastries, and brisket.
We're known for homemade corned beef hash. We do the Reubens with fresh roasted corned beef brisket. Over the door to the kitchen, we have 3,256 pounds of corned beef cooked since 1st of March 2014. That's in pounds.
That's a lot of corned beef. Algarin is a lifelong Republican who voted for Donald Trump for a number of reasons. He believes Trump will support veterans like him. He likes Trump's hard line on immigration because he says it's only fair to enforce the law. And he believes Trump represents a break from the past, a non-politician who might finally help working class guys like him.
Nothing changes. It just seems like the rich get richer and the little guys like myself that open up a hometown business, we employ local people and we just don't get anywhere.
What's the most important thing that needs to happen over the next 4 years for you as a small business guy right here in Winchendon?
There needs to be more businesses. At one time, this town was booming. Everything seems to be moving to another country.
Do you think President Trump will be able to help that?
I truly do believe he will. Everybody that's gone into office is a politician. My theory is we haven't had a president since Reagan. And he wasn't a politician. He wasn't a lawyer. You know, since I've been around, he's about one of the best ones we ever had.
Again and again, you hear a lot about these concerns in these towns. A sense of economic decline, a yearning to go back to the way things were, and a willingness to take a chance on a political outsider. Winchendon is one of more than a dozen central Massachusetts towns that voted twice for Barack Obama and then swung Republican to support Donald Trump.
Did they really go Republican? You know what they went with? They went with a non-political person.
This is Beth Hunt, who just opened Not Just Produced, a store in Winchendon that sells produce, grass-fed meats, and antiques. She says the election divided this town, so she won't say how she voted, because she doesn't want to drive her customers away. But she's not surprised that most people in town voted for Trump.
Everybody was tired of the politics, tired of the hands out. They were tired of the good old guys club. They were tired. People wanted change.
A lot of people agree with that, including Joe Ledoux, the owner of Winchendon Furniture, which has been around since 1939. It's one of the few businesses left in town that recalls the days when abundant water power fueled a woodworking industry that made everything from shingles and clothespins to toys and furniture.
Well, we've been a high-end store for decades, and we sold really furniture that would be expected to be passed down from generation to generation. And now the younger people don't appreciate that, but their values are completely different than their parents' and grandparents' values. They want to buy an inexpensive piece and just replace it when it needs replacing.
If you ask Ledoux how his business is doing these days, he chuckles and says, "I'm glad I'm old." So he expresses a sadness that a way of life is disappearing from towns like Winchendon. Ledoux supported the libertarian Gary Johnson because he says he's sick of the corruption in Washington. And he says it may be difficult for many around Boston to understand why so many of his neighbors voted for Trump, but he does.
Well, I just think they wanted a change. I think 495 is where Massachusetts really ends, and then we're a different part of the state. We're not the, you know, the Cambridges, and we don't have the politics that they have in the metropolitan area.
Someone who understands the politics of this area as well as anyone is Ann Gobi. She's the local state senator who represents 28 towns in central Mass that stretch from the New Hampshire line down to the Connecticut border. Gobi is a Democrat, and she knows that 25 of her towns, all but three of them, voted for Trump.
Does that make you feel a little vulnerable?
I suppose there were those that would say it would.
Were you surprised that he did as well among your 28 towns?
Absolutely not. No, I wasn't surprised at all that happened. I fully expected. In fact, I was surprised he didn't win all 28.
Gobi says that's because Trump was able to connect with voters in this part of the state, much as he did in parts of the industrial Midwest, with a promise to revive its lost economic vibrancy. It's a message that resonates in towns like Winchendon, which has lost its manufacturing base. It also faces a challenge from neighboring tax-free New Hampshire, which draws shoppers away from its downtown. And Winchendon is one of many towns in the middle of the state without a rail link to the east. Gobi says all this makes this part of the state feel overlooked by blue state Democrats. So she says Trump stepped in.
I think the Democratic Party, the state party specifically, has to not forget the people that live in my district. That when you go into a room, that I don't think you can expect that everybody in that room is going to be a college graduate. And they don't need to be. And I think it's extremely important to get back to what the Democratic Party represented, which was the working person.
Gobi says whether or not Trump can deliver on all his promises is another question altogether. But she says his message still speaks to her constituents in ways that Democrats in Washington and Boston do not. For New England Public Radio, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And on our next episode, Anthony's series continues with the view from another town that voted for President Trump, Ware, Massachusetts, the town that can't be licked. 5 years ago at 23, Andrew Forstoffel decided to walk 4,000 miles across America with a handmade sign that said, "Walking to Listen." Along the way, he recorded dozens of stories from the people he met.
Well, one good thing, you make a lot of good memories. Going out in the woods, just hunting old bottles.
I used to worry myself to death. And now I realize, you know, the things you worry about
How many of them come true?
When I see my Jesus face to face, and he said, that's the rule. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And I got to do what he said.
Now settled in Western Massachusetts, Forstoffel has a new book about his journey. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown recently joined him for a much shorter stroll.
Andrew Forstoffel lives above a beer supply shop on a busy commercial strip in Northampton. So we walk to a bike path where we have a few quiet miles to chat.
We'll take a left here.
This way? Okay.
Yeah, we'll take a right up on...
This is familiar terrain for Forstoffel, walking and talking. It's how he spent 11 months wandering from Chatsford, Pennsylvania, where he waved goodbye to his worried mother and set off on the railroad tracks, all the way to Half Moon Bay, California.
Before I walked across the country, walking was something I had done in sort of like in fits and starts, you know, little hiking trips. And then when I committed to a long distance through hike, walking became both my lover and my enemy, you know. It became my teacher. It became a meditation. And it was miserable too. Like, I don't want to romanticize how miserable the experience was.
When he started, Forstoffel was a recent graduate of Middlebury College in Vermont, still grieving his parents' divorce and looking for wisdom to guide him into adulthood. He'd hoped to travel to a small village in Africa, but he lost a well-paying job and needed a cheaper adventure. That's when he decided to fill a backpack with outdoor gear, a flip phone, a mandolin, and three books of poetry. With $4,000 in savings, he planned to camp when necessary, accept a free couch when offered, and record people's stories.
What sort of began to happen, I think, was that the walking primed me for connection with people. All of the hours I spent alone walking put me in this state of, well, basically loneliness. I was just damn lonely out there, you know? And to meet someone at the end of a day was just a miraculous thing to experience, because there was no guarantee that I'd be with anyone that night. You know, maybe I was going to be under a bridge alone again.
He followed a few self-imposed rules. He wouldn't accept any ride that would shorten the trip. He would use only paper maps, no internet or GPS, and he wouldn't listen to recorded music or podcasts.
I wanted to be approachable. I wanted people to feel that they wouldn't be interrupting me if they stopped and said something. So I chose not to wear earbuds.
Which also helped him focus on self-reflection and random observations.
I'd be walking along and I'd see a little strand of spider silk floating by, you know, and just be mesmerized. I would hear sounds that I wouldn't have heard otherwise. I'd feel things in my body that I wouldn't have felt otherwise. And so it all became a pretty entertaining spectacle.
He kept mostly to a southern route, and halfway through the trip, he bought a used baby stroller to help haul his stuff, which must have been quite an image, he concedes, especially during the occasional bout of crying along the lonely highway. He ate deep-fried squirrel, got lost in the desert, and sang Amazing Grace with an old woman in Alabama. He met many people outside the bubble of his middle-class youth, a trucker, prison guard, astrologer, a Christian missionary, ceremonial dancer, retired bounty hunter. He says they were often colorful, generous, and contradictory.
There's one woman and her husband who took me in to their home, took me out to dinner at Applebee's or something. We had a great interview that night, cooked me breakfast in the morning, and just as I'm heading out, she said, you should think twice about walking through this town coming up ahead. All the whites left and the help stayed. And the southern black is a whole different animal than the northern black.
Forstoffel says that kind of bigotry tended to shock him into silence, and he regrets not engaging people more in a discussion of their beliefs and his. He says that's one reason he wrote the book, to link the different perspectives he came across.
I wished so many times that people who I'd been with just the day before, who were warning me about the people in the next town over, I wish they could be with me that night when I went to that town and got to meet some of these people and actually listen to them.
He emphasizes that not only Southern conservatives could use a wider lens on the world, which is why he hopes his own example inspires future extreme walkers.
It would humble, the most bleeding heart liberal. It would have the potential to complicate things for them in a way that's very important, I think. You know, sort of erase the notion that anything is black and white. Including, a Trump supporter. A Trump supporter is more than a Trump supporter. What else are they?
Today, Forstoffel is a full-time writer and public speaker. After a spiritual awakening on his big hike, he studies Buddhism and meditates. If he were to take another cross-country listening walk, he says he'd do it with other people.
I want what low, but now I'm found what blind.
Andrew Forstoffel dedicated his book, Walking to Listen, to his mother.
You didn't join me.
I'll join you this time.
Twas great that
For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
Our thanks to transom.org for interview clips from Forstoffel's walk.
Yes, Lord. Love that voice.
Oh, I love yours. That was beautiful.
Oh, good.
Lego recently announced it would release a new line of toys immortalizing the women of NASA. The new set will feature astronauts Sally Ride and Mae Jemison, computer scientist Margaret Hamilton, astronomer Nancy Grace Roman, and mathematician Katherine Johnson of Hidden Figures fame. Commentator and author Martha Ackman says Lego shouldn't stop there.
Keep going. How about adding other women who push the bounds in space? In the early 1960s, a group of 13 hotshot women pilots were secretly tested to become astronauts. They took the same arduous exams as John Glenn, Alan Shepard, and the other Mercury men. Dr. Randy Lovelace, NASA's head of life sciences, was not surprised when women aced the tests, and he was disappointed when pushback immediately occurred. Why waste money and time testing women when men should go first, critics said. NASA agreed. That's when Jerry Cobb, leader of the Mercury 13 women, spoke out. She met with Vice President Lyndon Johnson, unaware that he'd already written a letter about Cobb's concerns to NASA. LBJ did not want the women's program to go forward. "Let's stop this now," he scrawled on the top of his typed letter. Cobb was not finished. She pushed for a special congressional hearing on astronaut qualifications. John Glenn was among those who testified. "Men go off and fight the wars and fly the airplanes," he said. "It is a fact of our social order." It took Congress less than a day to make up its mind. All astronauts would be drawn from the ranks of military jet test pilots. Since women were barred from that job, outer space was off limits as well. It would take the enormous social changes of the next decade before Sally Ride blasted off the launch pad in 1978. When Eileen Collins became the first woman to command the space shuttle in 1999, she invited the Mercury 13 women to stand in witness. No one knew who they were, just a group of older women with large handbags and water bottles. I stood next to them. As the space shuttle lifted off into a limitless sky, I turned when Wally Funk, one of the 13, began speaking quietly to herself. "Go, Eileen," she said. "Go for all of us."
Martha Ackman is the author of The Mercury 13, The True Story of 13 Women and the Dream of Spaceflight. She lives in Leverett, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really shouldn't miss. This show is produced by listener-funded New England Public Radio. Please give us a rating on iTunes, and while you're there, take a look at the other podcasts from NEPR. You can support these podcasts and all the news and music NEPR delivers to your car, your home, and your phone. Just go to NEPR.net and click the blue Contribute button near the top of the page. Again, thanks for listening. Until next time.